when we had the, yeah, because the propagator came to you as an integral of stuff, you know, k stuff, and there was a 1 over, you know, omega plus e minus I epsilon plus or minus, and I walked over this when I was doing this.
Yeah.
And I can't remember where the signs went. But each of these terms is a really Schrodinger perturbation term. If you just been doing non-relativistic Schrodinger perturbation theory, where you have, you know, things like sum over duration of the kind of change to the energy eigenvalue is, you know, n h interaction and squared divided by e n minus e n, things like that. You know, expressions like this that you would have gotten in perturbation theory and non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Each of these energy denominators is, each of these terms is one of those, essentially.
Right.
And it's a combination of the two of them together, which is giving you this propagator, which is covariant, together, and the time ordering was important in introducing the integral over omega that you didn't have before. So that's going to happen for every kernel line, which is what the first one is.
So this is what we define as a virtual particle that doesn't, that it's not a, like it's not a normal particle because it doesn't have a definite mass, I guess.
Yeah, it's not. That kind of naturally come in with the once you talk about finite graphs. So we're going to draw all these things, you know, as some process where, you know, things get moved around. And so the thing is that these lines, it's a mnemonic for perturbation theory. And so you can kind of physically think about it as if the particle produced another particle, which is radiated another particle, and that's the way you talk about it. But really, it's just a mnemonic for perturbation theory. Right. And the particles you're talking about were the eigenfunctions of the zeroth order Hamiltonian. Those are the particle states, the free particle states. And we were perturbing around that. And that's why it made sense to talk about these things as if they were particles. But it's true that the internal lines, you know, that was just some term on the sum. You're thinking of it as a particle because the thing you're summing over were particle states. But it was true that the details of the sum involved this integral, such that the momentum flowing along this line was not on the shell. And it's, so you're not really, you shouldn't really literally think that there's a particle there.
Okay.
And for many purposes, you could think as if it was a particle there, and then that doesn't steer you wrong. But if you really take it too literally, then you can confuse yourself.
I don't really think that's a problem.
Why would it be a problem?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things is this Schnatchel thing. If you really thought of it being a particle, then if you know its momentum, you know its energy.
Mm-hmm.
And what's contributing here is, you know, the answer we got was an integral e4p of, you know, 1 over p squared cosine squared minus pi epsilon and stuff. But here, the energy and momentum were totally arbitrary integration variables.
Sorry,
so the energy and momentum in the D4P are completely arbitrary integration variables, integrating over everything.
Yeah.
And you're not requiring the energy to live in any way but the momentum.
Okay.
So that's one way that you could let it straight. And in particular, if you did choose to relate the energy to the free momentum, then this combination here would have been zero. So the place where this is looking like a particle is where this is the most singular part of the expression. So that's useful. So it's useful to follow that, because that's going to be an interesting, a particularly interesting place in the amplitude will be that place where this particle is very close to being real. But that's not the only contribution to amplitude.
I guess I don't really see why we define a particle by necessarily meeting this
Well, particles, yeah, it's because the particle states were labeled by, you know, energy and momentum. But the thing is that we labeled it by, we took the we also can, we're characterizing, Lorentz invariant combination is PP, right? And that's something which you can label the whole representation by. So we call that minus M squared. But once I've done that labeling, then I'm no longer free to choose that one. Because this equation is relating this these two eigenvalues to the label of representation. So if you wanted to think of these things as being free variables that you can label freely, then you wouldn't want to think of particle having a mass, which is going to be particles typically come with characteristic mass, so you're thinking that their energy is then related to the momentum because you're thinking the mass is given to you. And so it's as if you're summing over all possible masses of these particles, if you like. But you're not taking, that doesn't mean you're summing over all possible particles because the couplings were specific. So the, you know, this was a Z-bone zone, so the couplings are very specific to both ends here. So it's kind of, it's related a little bit to the uncertainty principle that the, so that choosing the wrong energy is like, you know, as long as you do it fast enough, you can always violate the uncertainty principle. You can always violate energy conservation. So in a hand-waving way, that's probably not a very constructive way to think about it. But in this picture, the farther apart these particles got, so the longer this thing had to actually propagate. You know, in real life, particles are always detected by doing something. So that it's, you could argue that any particle you've ever seen actually had something stuck on both ends. Because, you know, if that was a photon that you saw from the Andromeda galaxy, something happened in your eye where that thing hit an electron. And so the things are always really, at some level, like this. But if you take these points and you make them very, very, very far separated, then what happens is that the dominant contribution is coming from the particle that's on shell. And so that, it's true that for these really very classical kind of situations, the dominant thing in the sum is the thing where you really you think of it as being a particle. But it, the closer these things get to one another, and the faster everything happens, the less and less dominated you are by a particle having the energy that's in the right place, much momentum. As you'll see, you know, we're going to talk about the Z resonance, and that you get the biggest contribution comes from when this thing is close to being satisfying energy is equal to square root of k squared with m squared. But there's still significant contributions where that's not true if it happens fast.
If you work in first order forms instead of second order forms of the Lagrangian, like we introduce extra fields and we go to the first order form, like in the case of electrodynamics, if we treat F union as an independent variable and write the first order Lagrangian for electrodynamics, then does any internal line come up with associated with this particle, this F union particles?
It's
are there any virtual particles associated to these extra fields?
At the end of the day, this is always relying on the Lagrangian in the non-interacting part of the Hamiltonian. However, that was quadratic in the variables, and in the so you can rephrase everything I'm doing in terms of a first order way of doing things. And once you've done that, you've got the same kind of perturbation theory. But the if you were to take the full theory in the first order form, you can always recast perturbation theory in the way I'm doing it and the way you're doing it, because changes of variables aren't going to really change anything in physics. But it might be that this is one of the three laws of theoretical physics, right? You can use any variables you like, but if you use the wrong ones, you'd be sorry. So it might be that in this other formalism, the perturbation theories may not be at all it's simple to see what's occurring in any given order. On Friday, I went to Atlas. I did a tour of the Atlas detector at the LHC, and it's awesome. I have to tell you that. That's kind of on board. It's huge. You see these pictures of, you know, here's a little man, here's a detector, and here's a little stick man. But you stand there, and it's like a four-story building, and it's underground. It's 100 feet underground. It's just phenomenal. And you really have a sense it's going to happen. They're all going like gangbusters trying to meet a deadline, which is months away. So you're months away from something happening. It's really, really exciting. So if you go to Geneva, you got to go do a tour. It's really, it's worth it. And your last chance is this summer, because they're going to close the place up soon. They had a left detector there too. They showed a Delphi, and I remember them when those were supposed to be cool. But they, you know, that was only about you could fit it in this room here. But, you know, it was like from there to there, a big circle. But this other one, just like, the whole building is a detector. Sort of that. Jacob, I think I just pulled a bit off. All right, so we were talking about muon decay. Mu goes to E, mu by E, mu. So this is not in a world where the neutrino masses were not there, and so we can imagine distinguishing the neutrinos. And there was, so I got, you know, we were beating on the propagator for a while there. And the bottom line was that we had an expression for the rates. For the matrix element, this is the name of the thing. The matrix element, it arose in second order. And the matrix element for this process was a bunch of fermion things. So there's coupling constants, E squared. Well, this is E squared over sine squared over U. And there's, depending on, just a one, we have U bar. I've got a different number of them here. So U bar, L, U, K. So let me label everybody in a second. So there's one combination of Dirac spinners coming from one of the vertices. And then we had U bar P V Q. So I could tell you who everybody was. We had this is the matrix element for the muon had momentum K, gets formed from electron and momentum P, and the element and Q, and then the mu neutrino, and then L. Because everybody's a fermion, the only antiparticle, we get to the antiparticles. So the only antiparticle is the antineutrino. So everybody's a U here except for. And if I didn't do that last time, then I lied to you. But I think I did that last time. And then we had, so you remember what the thing we're looking at here was something like we had E and nu bar. Then we had two interaction Hamiltonians, the charge current interaction. And we have a muon here. And it was a time ordered product. And so the thing where the fermions in here created these guys or destroyed this guy is what gave us this. These factors came from just the coefficients in the vertices, and that's where the gamma matrices came from. And this should have been a mu nu. And then the thing where the W boson gets created and destroyed was this propagator thing, which I beat on. And that gave us a factor, which was a k to mu nu plus and then we stick this into the, you know, we have a general expression for the rate in terms of the matrix elements. Where this thing is summed over final spins, average over initial spins. And so that's where what we're going to do with this second. But before doing that, we can take advantage of the, you know, things often simplify when masses are small or large. And this factor here is a complicated factor, but it's, in practice, you know, the components of, if we're in the rest frame of the muon, then the energies and momentum available to the electron and the electron neutrino, which is what P and Q are at most the muon mass. And so everybody in here, in that rest, in that frame, everybody in here is at most the muon mass squared divided by mw squared. So mu over mw, remember, muon is about 100 MeV, it's like 0.1 GeV, and MW is 80 GeV. So you're talking about things which are, you know, 1 over 800 squared, these contributions. So the relative size of this to this and this to this is 1 over 800 squared. And so to an accuracy of a percent or so, which is all we're hoping to get here, because things we haven't computed that were involved different interactions are already at the percent size, it's just kind of, we're working too hard keeping these terms and these terms. So it's a good approximation so that the large mass expansion for the is useful to do here and simplifies things a lot. So we can take this square thing that box off and approximate it as the M. So this is small compared to this, so I can just keep that. And the denominator, this is small compared to that, so the leading terms I just keep that. So I can think of this whole thing as being e to the new over mw squared. And if I wanted to go to second order, then I could Taylor expand everything in power of p. But whatever it is, it's you know, it's 1 plus order m mu squared over mw squared, which is really small. And that simplifies life a lot if we take this whole box and replace it by that. Because in that case, then I can drop this, and I can just lower that index, and I have an extra factor of mw squared here. That's and so all the actions in these matrix elements. So I just wrote that. I won't actually write that. But that's the approximation we're going to make. And then the only place that the W mass appears is really in this combination here. So it's combination e squared over sine squared theta and w squared. That's the famous combination because it appears in the, you know, a lot whenever you have w exchange like this. And it's traditional to write this as g over root 2. So that's the definition. And it's just not for historical reasons. And that's because, as you'll see, as long as you're making this approximation, then everything you do with a W virtual W exchange can be summarized in terms of an effective approximate interaction, which historically was written down well before the standard model ones. And so there's an effective Fermi theory of weak interactions, which was written down in the 30s, and then it was souped up in the 50s by Feynman and Marshak and Siddharth and Gell-Mann. And as you'll see, the standard model describes, it reduces in the limit that your things that are decaying are light compared to W mass to this effective theory. And this effective theory had a coupling constant that was just stuck in because no one knew what the strength of the interaction was, which they called G Fermi. And it happens that there's a conventional factor of root 2 in the way they define things back then. So this combination is when we actually go and look at the decay rate for the muon, it's going to be a function of this combination squared. And so it happens that you know, we know what MW, remember, E over sine theta was what we call G sub 2. And MW was 1/2 G sub 2 V. And so in this ratio, the G sub 2s cancel, and this can also be written as a 1 over 2 V squared. I just checked the 2s are right. And they're not because there's a. I forgot to write some factors of 2. So it's a conventional factor of 8. He said line. Oh, that's right. That's right. So this definition, there's a factor of 2 that I wasn't tracking here that appears. And those 2s actually, what they were. In the last class, I was writing things in terms of gamma left, not 1 plus gamma 5. And gamma left is 1/2, 1 plus gamma 5, and there are 2 of them. So there's factors of 4 right there. And so in the conventional comparison, where you define G Fermi, that's where part of it is. So bottom line is that I've told you that this V is experimentally 246 GeV. And now I can tell you that Y. The way that that's actually obtained is in the standard model, the muon decay lifetime is so well known that it's used to fix some of the parameters in Lagrange. And in particular, it fixes the value of G Fermi, because you can imagine that whatever we get is going to depend on this thing squared times the mass of the muon and the things that we know. And so if we know the mass of the muon, and we know we can measure the lifetime of the muon, then you can infer from that the numerical value of G sub Fermi, and that's what tells you that the Higgs effect. So when I tell you the Higgs effect is this, it's because we know what this quantity is, because muon decay is very well measured and theoretically very well understood. So the way to read this formula we're going to get from muon decay is that it's we're reading the measured lifetime to get what G sub Fermi is. And once we've done that, we can apply it to tau decays, where G sub Fermi is now known, and we can predict what the lifetime for tau is. So now we want to plug away and get what the rate is. And the exercise, if we use this for the m squared in the rate, we use the parameter. And use the same tricks as I told you before about taking the squares. So we're going to want to square these things involving the spinners. We can rewrite that as a trace of a Dirac matrices involving the dyadic UU bar and VV bar. Same exactly what I did for the Z decay. Then you're led to the following expression, which I'm just going to cut the trace for. I have it all aligned here nicely in order to go. So the differential rate. So 64 G Fermi squared divided by twice the energy of the decaying muon, which you knew had to be there because this rate in a general frame has to know about the time dilation of the rate in the rest frame, and that's what that energy is telling you. And there's dot products of the various four vectors, L dot P, P dot Q, this x 2 pi. Energy conservation is true. K minus P minus Q plus L. Then we have the phase space volumes, so P L over twice L zero P. And there's a 2 pi, each of these things have 2 pi cubed in it, so I'll get a 2 pi of 9 here. Okay. So at the end of the day, to get the rate, we have to do an integral, right? It's the one of the integrals is easy to do always, because the delta function does one of these integrals. And then that leaves us the energy conservation delta function does one of these integrals, and we're left with a 5-dimensional integral that has to be done. And that's the work part of the problem. And so just to sketch a simple way to do these integrals is, the integral we're trying to do at the end of the day is what? So we want to evaluate the business end of the integral. If I imagine doing the L integral with the delta function, the business end of the integral is the P and the Q, right? And this one in here is that let's just do two of the integrals and not worry about the third one yet. And it's going to be, the third one's going to be easy to do because the delta function will do it, but let's just carry it around for a while. If I want to, so I think to make contact with the nodes, I want to do the integral over L and Q first. So if we follow L and Q, then L plus Q is appearing in the delta function, then L and Q are appearing as the three variables here, and then the P and K are going along to the right, essentially. And we're looking for something which nominally is a function of the answer will be a function of the two arguments, P and K. So the integral we're trying to do here is the integral dPL over 2L dP Q. So this is a function of the of some function of a four vector W. What's useful about phrasing things, grouping this particular combination of the integrals, is that rather than the hard way to do these integrals is do them one by one, right? I do the integral with delta function, and I do dpx, dpy, or I do it in polar coordinates, and I do them by brute force. What's useful to do, the point of this exercise is that it's useful to group things that are Lorentz invariant, because then you can use any frame you like to make the integral as simple as possible. And so this has been chosen because, remember, d3 momentum divided by the energy that is a function of that momentum is a Lorentz invariant combination. And so I've got a Lorentz invariant combination here, a Lorentz invariant combination here, something which is a tensor, and then a Lorentz invariant combination here. And so whatever I'm going to get here, it has to be a Lorentz tensor built out of L, has two indices, and it's built out of one four vector of E. So on general grounds, it has to be A times, A to mu, or A could be built out of the Lorentz invariant combination W squared times A to mu, or it could be another thing, W mu, W nu. And those are the only things, that's the only thing that has the right tensor properties to be what the answer is, to be what the answer is. And so it's sufficient, in order to figure out what A and B are, it's sufficient to take the trace of this thing and to take W mu is this thing. So if I take I mu, that...
Well, is it
It's symmetric because I didn't ask for it to be symmetric, but if I ask what kind of tensors can I make out of W and eta, that's it. And they have to be symmetric. You can also argue here that symmetry is to do with interchanging L and Q. And this is symmetric under that, and measure is symmetric under that. So the integral, you would also argue from the integral having symmetric under A equals nu. But it's also true that if you just ask what's the tensor, don't ask for it to be symmetric. The only thing you can write with one vector is something which is symmetric. You're going to try to do something with an epsilon tensor, but then you need to have epsilon mu nu lambda rho. You have to soak up two indices of the W, and you can't do that and get something out of zero. So the trace here is let's call that, it's going to be 4a plus bw squared. And that's the integral, d3l over 2l naught, d3q over 2q naught. Times L dot Q times delta function. And if I contract W splice, I'm going to get W mu by mu. That's going to be A W squared plus B W to the fourth. And that's equal to the integral. But if I keep in mind that W is forced to be L plus Q in this integral, and that L and Q are the momenta, L is the momentum for the neutrino, and Q is the momentum for the neutrino, they're both momenta for massless particles, essentially, in the limit we're working in. So L and Q satisfy L mu and Q mu are neutrino momenta. And that means that essentially L squared and Q squared are zero. So L dot W, and also W is equal to L plus Q because of the delta function here. And so L dot W is really just L dot Q. And Q dot W is really L dot Q, because Q squared is going to die when I take the dot product of Q, and the L squared dies when I take the dot product of L. And W squared is, I guess I need to know. Oh, yes, I want to. So W squared is, if I square this, I'm going to get L squared to 0, Q squared to 0, so I'll get 2L dot Q. So that shows you that that this is L dot Q, which is really W squared, and W is something which is the answer. It's the thing that's being, it's something that the thing is being held fixed in the integral. And so this factor here and this factor here is really something which pulls out the front of the pulls out of the integral, because it's really, I can write this as being 1/2 W squared, and this is just, this is L dot Q squared, so that's 1/2 W squared squared. And so that means the only integral we really have to do is what's left. So all we really need is I, which is integral D3L over 2L naught, D3Q over 2Q naught, L plus 4 of W minus and L minus Q. If you tell me what that is, then I know that 4A plus B W squared is equal to 1/2 W squared I. I know that A W squared plus B W to the fourth is equal to 1/2 W squared squared times I. And so if you tell me what I is, I can solve these two linear equations for A and B and let me know what the answer is. What do I solve for A and B? And so the way to do this integral is to choose, since it's again, it's a Lorentz, this is, that was a Lorentz tensor. This is a Lorentz scalar. So that was Lorentz covariant, this is Lorentz invariant. And so that means that its answer is the same in any frame we evaluated. So let's just choose a simple frame. It depends only on W squared. So this is some function W squared. And what do we know about W? W is a 4 vector, which is the sum of L plus Q. Its square was 2L dot Q. But L and Q were future-directed light-like vectors. And so so what I want to argue is that W squared is a timeline vector, future-directed timeline vector. Since L squared Q squared is 0, and W is L plus Q, that means W squared is less than 0, less than or equal to 0. It would be equal to 0 if L and Q happen to be parallel to one another. You know, if I just take this and square this, this is going to be, that is 2L dot Q, so that's minus 2 the energy of L, you know, say L 0, Q 0, plus 2 Q dot L. So if I write that in terms of the absolute value of L, it's the absolute value of L, the absolute value of Q, which is the, that's the energy, there's an overall factor of 2, and I've got minus 1 plus cosine theta, where theta is the angle between Q and L. So since cosine theta is always, you know, between 1 and minus 1, this thing is negative. And so at best it's 0 if cosine theta happens to be plus 1. And that corresponds to the case where L and Q are parallel. But otherwise, it's not. It's something which is negative. And so that shows you this whole thing is negative, and shows you that W squared is negative. And that means that W mu is timeless. Because it's timelike, it has a rest frame. So the simple thing, the simple frame in which to evaluate I is the one where W is in the rest frame. So let's just choose the rest frame. So since I is invariant, not covariant, we can evaluate it in any frame. I since W squared is time like, we can choose the rest frame. So we'll choose the rest frame for W. That's the one for which this is equal to, say, capital W 0, 0, 0. So W squared, in that case, W mu will just be minus W squared in that case. And in that case, this delta function is simple. Delta of the fourth of W on the panel minus Q just becomes delta of W minus L0 minus Q0, L cubed of L plus Q. And then the integral you just do, because it's not a very complicated integral. This integral gets done by the delta function. The angular part of this integral you have to evaluate, but the spatial, the radial part of this integral is essentially going to be done by the by this, because L naught is a del. So this is delta W minus L Q. So the only thing that's left is the integral over the angles, and the integral over the angles is, you know, 4 pi, because there's nothing to the angles anymore. So the bottom line is that I in that case turns out to be something simple. Now the way I define an I in the book, it's a factor of 2 pi squared anywhere. So let me just work backwards. So I turned out to be 1 over 8 pi times theta. Squared, be pi over 2. This is pi over 2. We're looking for a function of W squared. It is a function of W squared because it's only non-zero when W is W squared is negative. So there's a step function here for minus W squared. Since W mean must be kind of like, or in the string case, it could be null. So we can just work backwards now. That tells us what A and B are. So that tells us what I and U is. That tells us what this, what these intervals do for us. If we integrate those guys, then you have an expression for the rate. The reason we integrated those guys in the first place was that they were the neutrinos, and those are the ones you never see, right? And then in the decay process, you're never going to be able to ask what the rate is as a function of where the neutrinos go, because that's really hard to figure out, given the neutrinos will go through light years of lead before they hit anything. So, so cut to the chase. You're left with an integral over the momentum of the electron. And again, in the rest frame, if we don't have a polarized muon, and if we just average over the all possible polarizations, there's no vector in the problem to start off with. So if we've integrated over all the final neutrino directions, the answer has to be isotropic. It has to be equally likely for the electron to go in any direction because of rotational invariance. And so the angular integral in the P integral is going to be a factor of 4 pi. And the only integral that's left to do is the integral over the energy of the electron. And so that expression plugged into that formula will give us the differential rate as a function of the electron energy. So what you find is that if the energy, so let me give you the expression. If I define the curly E to be the electron energy divided by the muon mass, and the curly mu to be the electron mass divided by the muon mass. Yes, that's right. And the differential rate is carry squared and u on the fifth divided by 4 pi cubed. And there's a kinematic factor, which is epsilon 4 epsilon squared over 3. So this is something which turns off when the if the energy of the electron becomes the energy of the mass electron, the whole thing has to die. That's true, but that's true, but it's not such a surprise. Yeah, right. So this is something which this is the first time. You know, up until now we had two body decays, and if you kind of plotted the number of decays against the energy of one of the decay products, up until now we've always had something which came out at a specific energy. The energy, if the decay products had the same mass, this energy was half the mass of the thing that decayed. So there was a very specific energy that was being produced in a two-body decay. And that was because in the rest frame, the momentum conservation made the momenta equal. And then the energy conservation says the sums of the energies has to be some known thing. But if the momenta are equal, then that means, if you think of the masses being the same, you can see that if the momenta are equal, their energies are equal. So then it has to be their energy or half the energy that's available. And so energy and momentum conservation give you a unique answer for energy in the rest frame of the decaying thing. That did not happen here because of the three-body decay. So in this case, what we got is something which is, we plot the gamma of the epsilon on the epsilon. It's something which kind of grows and it hits some value, maximum value. So the most likely thing for the electron comes out most probably with as much energy as it can. But there's a sub-probability for the electron to have any energy at all in this range. And this, so there's an E max here. And then E max would be that's the limiting case where the electron carries all the energy that was available, and no one else is carrying anything. In all the other cases where the electron carries less energy, what's happening is the neutrinos you didn't see carried up off the rest of it. And because you didn't measure them, you have some sort of a chance that it could be anything here. So a three-body decay and higher. Gives you a continuous spectrum. And the history of the weak interactions was actually tied up a lot with whether beta decays had this property, because that was going to tell you if there are two things came out or three things came out. And the existence of the neutrino, at the end of the day, came down to the, once people became sure that beta decays and nuclei had this form, rather than this form, they told them that something else was coming out. You had a nucleus turned into another nucleus plus an electron, and the question was there something else in addition to the electron? And if there had been nothing else, you would have accepted this. And finding that continuous decay was a crisis if you didn't know it was a neutrino. And so that's kind of how the neutrino was postulated. The total rate becomes, so if we neglect the electron mass, so if we just take that, take this to be zero, then the total rate becomes G Fermi squared mu to the fifth divided by a famous factor of 192 pi cubed. So if you plug in this value here, corresponds to the measured value of G Fermi comes from comparing that to the lifetime, and it turns out to be 1.1 something to the minus 5 GeV to the minus 2. So it's basically 10 to the minus 5 GeV to the minus 2. And that corresponds to this expression being the lifetime, the mean life, which is 100 gamma, is 2, I think, something like 2, right, 10 to the minus 6 seconds. So basically, muons live for a microsecond or so, which is a long time compared to anything we've talked about so far. You know, we had the taus, with the w's and the z's, we're living for 10 to the minus 20 something seconds. This is something where if you're moving at speed of light, you can go, you know, hundreds of meters. So this is something where muons can actually travel at great distance. We see muons from the top of the atmosphere. That's kind of why we can. That's part of why we can. They actually couldn't have made it from the top of the atmosphere without also having immense time dilation. But certainly in a detector, you can see these guys. They you have a collision like you tend to get in places like LEP. You have some sort of detector, some sort of oscillator in theory space. what typically happens is that the electrons do things and the hadrons do things, and they dump a lot of energy in the detector. But the muons, for reasons that will come later on, rifle their way out. And they'll go a long ways up. So they actually will leave the detector. And so they're normally detected by surrounding the detector with these muon detectors in all different directions. And you kind of see them much farther away than everything else. And unlike the W's and Z's, which can't escape because they don't live long enough, the muons really, although they do decay, effectively can go hundreds of meters, which is much bigger than these detectors, which are tens of meters in size. Okay. The only thing that should surprise you about the answer that we got, so remember that gamma was g from squared n tau mu to the fifth through 90 to pi. The only thing that is a surprise here is the 192. Because if you had to guess, estimate what the answer was here, we can follow the coupling constants, we can follow the powers of the mass of the thing that's decaying, because that's just dimensional analysis. We can follow the pi's because we know where they come in. And so we knew that on general grounds, the matrix element we were trying to estimate came from this. So we know that the amplitude had two factors of the coupling constant. It had two factors, one of Ramw squared because of this argument about the propagator for the W being dominated by the small masses. So that tells us that if we had to just estimate, we would have said that gamma, the matrix element should have been proportional to E squared over sine squared theta, because that's what W couples to. It had a 1 over Mw squared, because that's the statement that if the W is heavy, the propagator looks like 1 over Mw squared. So that rate, which is essentially the matrix element squared, integrated over phase space. So that had to be proportional to, you know, this combination is what we call basically G Fermi. So this thing had to be proportional to G Fermi squared because we squared the amplitude. The integral here is over energies and momenta of final state particles. And if all the masses of the thing that we're decaying into are small compared to the thing decaying, the energy available in the decay is mu. So on dimensional grounds, this is 1 over time. So if h bar and c are 1, that's an energy. This is 1 over, G Fermi was 1 over a mass squared. So G Fermi squared is 1 over a mass to the fourth. We're missing an overall factor of energy to the fifth to make the dimensions work. The only energy in the problem in the phase space is the mass of the thing decaying. So that had to be mu to the fifth. The two pi's came about because we had, altogether we had for each phase space integral, for each of these guys, we had 1 over 2 pi cubed. So if you have to count the two pi's, we have a 1 over 2 pi cubed and we need three of them because it's three things in final state. We had the 2 pi from the delta function conserving, you know, conservation method. And then we had a bunch of integrals over angles to do with the directions of these P3Ps. And each one of them gives us a 4 pi, which is 2 pi, morally speaking. So we had three of them, so we should have 2 pi cubed. We've done that right, and then we've got 2 pi cubed in the end. Yes. Oh. So what did I do wrong?
Doesn't your delta function kill one of the solid angle integrals?
Yes, thank you. That's it. So remember, the delta 3 here was done by just removing one of the integrals, angles, and modulus. And so that one of the angular integrals is done by the delta function that goes to 5. So that says that this, what we're expecting is something which looks like G Fermi squared mu to the fifth divided by 2 pi cubed. So we're expecting an 8 here, and we got 192 here. And that's because this was a multi-dimensional integral, and we did it on dimensional grounds, and that wasn't, we treated like a big ball in three-dimensional space, or I guess it was more like a nine-dimensional space. And that's not such a good approximation for the regime you're integrating. And so that's why the 192 might have surprised you. But the rest of this depends on something which is really predictable and very simple. And the difference that makes a difference between, you know, microns and something which is significantly different. Any questions about that? That's, being able to estimate those things is really useful. So, what about for taus? What's the difference for tau decay? What do you expect for tau decay, given that you know what's happening for muon decay? Well, one thing you should expect is that let's look at the channel. So tau goes to, could go all the way to electron, new electron bar, so it's a tau minus, what's the electron minus, and tau. That particular process is verbatim. The interactions are the same. The only difference is that the masses are different. And so what we should expect here is that the rate for tau goes to E nu nu bar should be basically E parity squared and tau over 192 pi cubed. And so in particular, the tau, the branching, the rate for this is E nu nu bar divided by the rate for muons going to E nu nu bar is essentially just m tau over m mu in the fifth power. And that's basically, you know, 1.5 GeV divided by 0.1 GeV in the fifth power. So you're picking up a factor of 10 to the fifth power. So they're significantly different because there's more energy available in tau. Tau is more energetic, there's more momentum states it can decay into. And so when you sum over all, the amplitude for each decay is the same, so m squared is the same, but when you integrate over all the states available, there's more states, more electron states you can get, given you had more energy to liberate for the tau. So it'll have a shorter lifetime. So it's only partly shorter, it's not going to be exactly 100,000 times shorter, because the tau has other channels that can decay into. It doesn't have to decay into electrons, it can decay into muons as well, because muons are also electrons. And it can decay into quarks. We can imagine having an up and a down quark here, because those things, you won't actually get decays into quarks, but if you sum over all possible hadrons that it could decay into, there are some that are light enough for tau to decay into, because we could have had a pion here or something, which is carrying off the... So if we had had the tau goes to, let me write this down, so there's more channels. So we can have tau goes to mu bar nu tau. We could have tau goes to, we want to have a negative charge the other day, so we want to have up bar down. And we won't get an up bar down, but an up bar down is going to turn out to be a pion. So that would be what you'd really expect to hear would be something like pi minus nu bar in the new town. But you might also have a strange quark here, and that could be a kaon in the town. And those will all go because the mass of these things are less than a GeV, whereas this, you got a GeV's worth of energy to get rid of here. So there's a bunch of hadronic final states you could get, depending on which quarks you put in. You cannot have a charm quark, say, because a charm quark is too heavy to be produced by a tau. But you can have an S quark, and you can have a D quark, and you can have a U quark, and so there's various combinations that you can get here. And again, the story here is like it was for Z decays, that you can't expect to get a good estimate of the decay rate into pions by doing the decay rate into quarks. But if you sum over all possible quarks, you can get a good expression for the decay rate into all possible hadronic final states. Because, again, you're summing over all possible, you're summing over a projection matrix in Hilbert space onto any strongly interacting thing. And that doesn't depend on the basis of doing it. So what we'd expect is that the rate for tau goes to, to the extent that we can forget if we neglect the muon mass and the electron mass compared to the tau mass, then we expect this to be basically also the same as the rate for tau goes to mu in the bar if we neglect tau, because then the answer just depends on tau. But the rate into quarks is going to also pair with the fact that the coupling constant for quarks is different because it's this KM matrix that controls the size, right? So the rate for tau goes to up quark of flavor m and down quark of flavor n at new tau. It's going to be the same kind of a calculation. If we neglect the mass of these quarks compared to the tau, then it'll be the same kind of expression. The g frame squared times the absolute value of the corresponding KM matrix, V and N there. Neglecting quark masses. So M up, just to remind you, is something like a few GeV, something like 5 MeVs, right? Let's say 0.005 GeV. M down is something like 0.010 GeV. And M strange is something like 0.2, depending on how you count GeV. Whereas M top, or M tau, sorry, is about 1.5 GeV, if I remember correctly. So for these two, this is a pretty good approximation to neglect these things. We're neglecting the square of this divided by this. For this one, it's not such a fantastically great approximation, but it's not so bad. So to the extent this is right, then if we calculate the branching fraction, say for tau, goes to, let's say the total rate first, tau goes to all, that's going to be, to the order we're working, that's the rate for tau goes to E mu nu. That's the rate for tau goes to mu mu nu. That's the rate for tau goes to quark bar. So that's going to be, that's overall T Fermi squared times tau to the fifth over 192 pi cubed times, you know, 1 plus 1, these two, plus. So we're supposed to sum over m that has to be an up quark, because we can't have a charm quark and a top quark without violating energy conservation. And n can be a down or a strange quark, but it can't be a bottom quark, because the bottom quark is too heavy again. So v m n squared. I wanted to Oh, and there's a factor 3, which I always forget. That's because there's colors, right? There's a have to sum over all the final quark properties, and one of those properties is color. This is the number of colors. M is an up type quark and N is a down type quark.
Why can't you have an up quark?
Oh, because the basic vertex we're talking about was a W, which had two fermions. But the thing is, a W carries charge.
Okay, sorry, yeah.
And so you couldn't have been concerned about your charge number. Now, the thing I want to say here is that this is basically, the sum is basically 1. Why is that? What we know is that V was a unitary matrix, so we know that sum over all possible down effects, if you had said that this was sum over D, S, and V, like V, and right, and that would be 1, because that's, in a unitary matrix, you know, if I take the rows and columns, the sum of the squares of all the rows and all the columns is 1 in the unitary matrix. That's the statement of unitarity. So that's, in particular, if I sum over the U row, and I get 1. And here I just not summed over the last one, but this last one is actually small, because remember the hierarchy and the KM matrix, the diagonal guys are basically 1. The off-diagonal guys, that are off-diagonal by one element, were 0.2-ish. But the ones over here tend to be 0.2 cubed, so there's a they're considerably smaller. So, what we want, VUD squared plus VUS squared is approximately, or is equal to 1 minus VUB squared. But this is something which is VUB is of the order of 0.2 cubed, if you remember. And so VUB squared is of the order of 0.26. And although 0.2 is not such a big deal, 0.2 to the 6 is a big deal, a small deal, so that's the approximate part. To the x that we're working. So this is basically another way of writing 5. So that's 3 plus 2. So what that tells you is that what do you expect for taus? You expect the branching ratio, the fraction of times tau goes to e mu nu bar. Remember, that's defined to be the rate for that process divided by the total thing. That's something which has the advantage that most of these factors drop out, and it just depends on coupling constants. It should be basically 1 to 5. And that should also be very similar to the rate for the branching fraction for tau goes to mu in the bar. And the rest of it is the hadron. So tau goes to hadron mu should be about 3/5. And the experimental numbers are actually not a bad description. And I don't know if I actually gave you the numbers. Yes, I do. So the experimental numbers are. So the experimental number here for tau goes to e mu nu is 17.84 plus minus 0.06%. So rather 20%. This is 17.37 plus minus 0.06%. It's different at the error level, largely because the masses, you know, neglecting the mass of the muon is not such a good approximation in this case. The muon was about a tenth of the tau mass, so that squared is a percent change. That's an error here, which is bigger than this experimental error. And then the hadrons are, the measured rate for tau goes to strange hadrons, so things with kaons in it. Strange maybe is about 2%. 2.7 plus or minus 0.9%. And then B for non-strange. And it was 62 plus or minus 4. So the level of this is going to have the corrections to this prediction are going to be bigger than the corrections to this prediction because this is going to care about the strong coupling constant. And so that's going to give you a larger subleading contribution. So when you're predicting 60 here, and you're getting 65 or so, the ratio of these two things should also be understandable, because the fraction of times it goes to a strange versus a non-strange port is really to do with those two things. So VUS, remember, was something like 0.2, and VUD was something like 1. So this ratio, VUS squared divided by VUD squared is something like 0.04. So you naively expect it to be about a 4%. 4% of the time, if it goes to hadrons, it should go to strange hadrons. And that's not quite what happened here, right? Because we had a total of 4% out of, that's not so far. 4% of all the cases are going to strange things, as opposed to where That's including all the electronic stuff. So given that the corrections that are the strongly interacting part of this story is the one that's more and more dicey. As you start trying to pick apart the remember the argument was that you can calculate what is happening to the quarks and conclude what's happening to hadrons as long as you sum over everybody. And so there, you don't need to do that. You predict 60% and you get 65%. But the corrections are, the sublinear corrections in this case are bigger than they would have been in the, for the ZDK, because this, what counts here is a strong interaction coupling constant at the mass of the tau, which is actually larger than, than it was for the mass of the Z for reasons we'll get to later on. But if you start picking apart the hadron into strange and non-strange, then it's a, that could be, I argued before you could do that, provided that you could argue that you have identified a conserved quantity, which is a, so you're summing over all hadrons subject to some fixed quantum number, which is conserved. And that's kind of a dicier and dicier business the more this thing is not conserved. And the conservedness of the strangeness, that's one thing. Second thing is that we're neglecting the strange quark mass, which is not such a negligible thing in the case of, the strange quark mass is 0.2 compared to the tau mass, which is 1. So that this ratio being is different than so just in my head, it's going to be 0.04, 0.05 divided by 0.6. It's, without it being 0.5, we would have had 1% rather than 4%. That's not such a bad thing given the uncertainty of that ratio. The main message is that you can really go a long way towards understanding these ratios, or these branching ratios, just in terms of the coupling constants. And a lot of the other stuff just drops out and is irrelevant. So, again, it's hours of endless fun looking at the part of the data book and seeing the standard model really describe what you see. That's a good break point, though, because. The next thing to do is the Feynman rules. That's and there is an issue with how much detail it gives you. Feynman rules are something which no one can ever tell you a Feynman rule. Feynman rules at some level you have to believe them yourself. So I'll go through the rules by summarizing them because there's a couple tricky ones, but really working through examples is the way to really make it happen with the Feynman rules. Any questions on this stuff? All right, so we'll see you guys at 3:30.